Taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the next case, Trustees, Chicago Painters and Decorators versus La Costa.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen McDowell, and I'm the attorney for the trustees of the Chicago Painters Pension, Health and Welfare, and Deferred Saving Plan Trust Funds. Basically, in this case, the district court's decision represents the first time that we are aware in which an express written agreement, number one, to abide by a collective bargaining agreement, and number two, to abide by association bylaws delegating bargaining rights, to an employer association was negated by an employer's failure to adhere to the terms of its written agreement. Under this court's decision in Blackmore Sewer, the signing of an agreement agreeing to be bound to a collective bargaining agreement represents the conclusive evidence of intent to be bound for purposes of the Gluckert decision, and the Pepper decision, and the Gibeliudzius decisions of this court.
The practice normally dealing with non-union employers is to provide a cover letter which explains what's happening if they sign it. Isn't that the case?
In this case, yes, it was, because in that, actually what we have, if we look at this particular case, we have a case in which the solicitation involved here was involved primarily and basically exclusively to persons who already were bound to a collective bargaining agreement with the painters in this case. They received a cover letter. In this case, no solicitation was made by the PDCA to the employers in this case. Instead, the employers in this case submitted, unsolicited, to the funds a signed agreement under which their president signed an agreement directly below a legend stating not only that they agreed to be bound by the terms of the current collective bargaining agreement, but secondly, that they agreed to be bound by the terms of the constitutions and bylaws, both of which were available to them had they requested them.
I guess the answer to my question is yes, it was not accompanied by.
Yes, yes, it wasn't. You know, the record is clear in this case that was involved, because basically in this case, this employer was not directly solicited, but the employer submitted.
I understand
submitted.
It wasn't done intentionally. They just got the application from somebody else.
That's what the record reflects here.
But it does. The cover letter's intent is to explain to these people what the consequences are of signing or joining the organization.
Well, that's right, because the association is going to attempt to explain to people what the reasoning is and what's involved here. And as this court recognized in Gibeliudzius, this is a desirable thing. I believe in footnote 3 it indicated, well, it's desirable for a fund to do, not for a fund, but in this case for an employer association to do that, but that it isn't required, that basically the burden rests upon the employer who signs the agreement to read the agreement, to learn what it means, and to learn the consequences of its signature. It's not the responsibility of the employer association, and certainly not of the funds who are third-party beneficiaries in this case. When we compare this case to other cases in which this court has wrestled with the issue of whether employers should be bound to the terms of a collective bargaining agreement by virtue of membership in a multi-employer association, the Gibeliudzius case, the Gluckert case, and the Pepper case, this case is the only one in which there was specifically an employer signature below a legend stating that they agreed to abide by the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. Secondly, this case, along with Gibeliudzius, represent the only cases in which there was a specific agreement to adhere to bylaws, which was signed by the president of the involved company. And the bylaws in this case explicitly provide that there is a delegation of bargaining rights to the employer association involved. Now, none of the district court's points excusing the failure to adhere to the terms of this express delegation of bargaining rights has any significant merit. Initially, as we touched upon before, there was an assertion by the district court that there was a failure to provide the employer with the documents or for the employer to read the documents. But under this court's decisions in ANC Environmental and Fonkook Machine and the fact that an employer does not read a contractual agreement to which it is bound does not negate the fact that the employer may explicitly agree to the terms of that agreement. In fact, the G. Bliudzius case, footnote 3, which I referred to earlier, fairly explicitly makes that point. Secondly, the district court endeavored to distinguish among various classes of membership, asserting that there were three different classes of membership, only one of which bound the employer to the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. However, had the bylaws been read, it would have been apparent that the only classification of membership which applies to an active painting contractor is active membership, which binds the employer to the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. Finally, the district court asserted that there was some type of, it believed, fraudulent or shady type of conduct on the part of the employer association. As indicated previously, the employer association did not specifically solicit this employer. Instead, it received a filled-out application stating that the employer agreed to be bound by its terms. So, in essence, there was not any sort of misrepresentation of what was being signed. In fact, there wasn't a representation specifically in this matter at all. And therefore, the employer association's conduct, especially when you're dealing with the rights of a third-party beneficiary benefit fund, simply is not a situation in which fraud can be a defense. In fact, this court's decision in Gerber Truck fairly clearly makes certain that fraud in the inducement is not, in fact, a defense to a benefit fund's action to collect contributions under ERISA. And the reason for that is very simple. Otherwise, benefit funds would be caught up consistently in having to go behind all the specific machinery of the negotiations between the employer association and the employer to determine whether there was an intent to be bound. The purpose of Gerber Truck is that the benefit funds should be entitled to take the written documents as they are supplied them, based upon those written documents, enforce the terms of the collective bargaining agreement and the rights under to contributions under ERISA. Accordingly, then, it's the position of the funds that the district court's decision should be reversed, summary judgment entered in favor of the funds, and then the matter remanded pursuant to Circuit Rule 36 for a determination as to specific damages and contributions owed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCallum. Mr. O'Neill.
May it please the Court. Stephen O'Neill on behalf of the defendant, Appellee LaCosta. This is a case that I think proves the wisdom of this Court's decision in Moriarty versus Gluckert. That mandates that agency issues in the context of multi-employer association collective bargaining be treated with more factual precision than in the typical ordinary agency situation. And so that rather than focus very narrowly on a few words, what the appellant has attempted to do is ignore all of an overwhelming set of facts that make it clear that there was no manifestation of any intent on the part of LaCosta to be bound by the collective bargaining agreement in question. The only act, though, that they can point to
I assume that your argument really boils down to she signed this but really didn't know what it was. Didn't realize the ramifications of signing this. It was signed in air, or it was a bunch of things on her desk.
That's right. She has no recollection of having signed it.
But it is her signature.
It's been stipulated in the district court that it is her signature. I want to point out, though, that unlike many of the cases cited by the appellant, Gerber and its progeny involving actual fully integrated collective bargaining agreements signed by a party who then tries to evade some of his obligations based on some sort of side agreement or fraud in the inducement, this is the only act here that on which they rely, and that is the signature on a one-page application form, a fill-in-the-blank sort of application form, that is signed at the bottom by the president. And here in this situation, and we've seen it in Pepper, an opinion of this court, Moriarty versus Pepper, a case very close on its facts, did involve an application form that said I agree to be, in that case, bound by and not just abide by the Constitution and bylaws of the association I'm joining. But in Pepper, relying upon a very similar sort of application, and was really very similar constitution and bylaws, the court said that that wasn't enough, that we would look at all of the surrounding facts and circumstances to determine whether there's been a delegation. And that was the important distinction the court drew between Pepper and Bluzius. Is there a real written delegation of authority? And there's no delegation language in this application. The court in Pepper found that the documents in and of themselves were insufficient and directed the district court to consider those facts under all of the factors enunciated by this court in Glueker to be relevant to the determination of whether in the multi-employer setting there has been a delegation of authority. Here, the facts, as I mentioned, are overwhelming. We have this one-page form signed by the president under circumstances where even the document itself, as counsel said, was never even intended to be a document that would recruit new members to the association. The letter that Judge Caney referred to is a letter normally that goes out to prospective new members and explains in much clearer terms, by joining, you're automatically delegating your authority to the association. This doesn't say anything. There's no language of delegation. There's no language of assignment.
But it's fairly typical if you're joining an association that bargains that you're going to be bound by.
Well,
I mean, this is not an unusual situation.
Well, not so in this industry, and I would point to some facts established unequivocally in this record, which are that LaCosta was actually a member of two related associations, the National PDCA and the Illinois PDCA. Neither of which are unionized. And so in this industry, to happen for Ms. Mota to have seen an application that looked much like the application to join the National PDCA and to have signed off on it is not very surprising. They were already a member, clearly already a member of two associations, one of which, the Illinois PDCA, they had just paid their dues weeks before. And so those facts, I think, make it clear that just by joining in this industry is not something that would lead an employer to conclude that they were necessarily going to be bound by collective bargaining agreements. Another fact in this case that I think makes it clear that there could not have been any intent is that, in fact, LaCosta had signed a collective bargaining agreement with a different union covering the same geographic area sometime before. So if ever under Glueker there was evidence of an independent intent to engage in bargaining independently, it is so clear here that it really can't be overlooked. This is a case where all of the facts point to the fact that there is no manifestation in this case of an unequivocal intent to be bound, and that's what Glueker requires, and Glueker requires that this court or the district court exercise a certain amount of factual precision to make that determination. And that factual precision has been held in Glueker, Pepper, and all of the cases that have come through the district court to require an assessment of all of the facts and circumstances. Even the law of common law agency law that would apply under these circumstances requires that the authority issue be determined in accordance with all the facts and circumstances. And the Glueker court made reference to the restatement of agency on the subject, and I would mention the restatement of agency section 26, which is the one cited by the court in Gluckert, as well as Section 34, which requires that circumstances be considered, that all circumstances be considered in interpreting a delegation of authority, including, among a long list, Section 34E, the formality or informality, and the care or lack of it with which an instrument evidencing the authority is drawn. And here, I think a one-page application form signed under very understandable circumstances that, in fact, when received by the Chicago PDCA, as much as they insist upon technical enforcement of their bylaws, was never even approved by their board of directors as required by their bylaws, is a situation where I think the facts and circumstances point clearly to the lack of a manifestation of an intent to be bound.
Isn't there some evidence also that it was recognized as a mistake?
I think there is. There was a board meeting at which this document was considered, as well as others, and the board recognized that, contrary to their requirements for this particular free membership drive, that La Costa was not in good standing with the funds because it wasn't already a member. So they couldn't vote at the time on approving the membership, and instead, sometime later, through a telephone call between the executive director of the association and its president, who was also a trustee of the funds, he said, go ahead and approve it. Now, the testimony was, he said, I think he told me he polled some of the board members. But in fact, there is no evidence of compliance by the association with its own constitution and bylaws they attempt to enforce so rigidly in this case. Finally, I would say that the court in Gluckert has moved in a direction, I think, different from Bluzius and what the appellant proposes should be a standard here. And I submit that this is a case where there is such overwhelming evidence of a lack of intent on the part of La Costa that the summary judgment entered by the district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. You have 2 minutes, Mr. McDowell.
Just a couple of different points. Initially, with respect to the unequivocal intent to be bound, this decision, court's decision in Blackmore Sewer, I think, makes very clear that an employer's signature on a document agreeing to be bound by a collective bargaining agreement represents the unequivocal intent to be bound for purposes of Gluckert. With respect to the Pepper decision, there was no bargaining delegation involved in the Constitution and bylaws in that case. There is a very clear delegation involved in the Constitution and bylaws of the PDCA. Also, the particular signed document in this case contained not only an agreement to be adhered to the terms of the Constitution and bylaws, but also to agree to the adhere to the terms of the collective bargaining agreement itself. It was playing on the what was signed in this particular case. There was a 70-year custom in this case of the Chicago PDCA binding all active members. That's clear from the bylaws. The bylaws have not been changed since 1934. With respect to the argument that the Chicago PDCA didn't follow its particular procedures, it's a Illinois nonprofit corporation. Any issues as to irregularities is inapplicable between the two parties to the case and certainly would be inapplicable in the case of a third-party beneficiary, a benefit fund attempting to enforce the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. With respect to agency, the benefit fund was simply supplied with language indicating, number one, that there was an agreement to adhere to the collective bargaining agreement, and as a third-party beneficiary fund, it must enforce the contractual agreements that it has before it. It cannot go behind the thing and attempt to determine, well, what might be the particular facts. Otherwise, one would have a situation in which conduct contrary to the terms of a collective bargaining agreement or contrary to the terms of a written undertaking could somehow negate the terms of the written undertaking. That simply isn't the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McDowell. Thanks to both counsel, or Mr. O'Neill. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move